You're listening to listener-supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. We're online at WPKN.org. I'm Valerie Richardson. I'm very happy to welcome Emily Bernard to the airwaves. Hi, Emily. How are you?
Hi, Valerie. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And Emily teaches at the University of Vermont. You're the Julian Lindsay Green and Gold Professor of English. And a professor of critical race and ethnic studies. And I met Emily a number of years ago, in New Haven through mutual friends. And as you were doing some research, you did your undergraduate and graduate degrees at Yale, but you've been in Vermont for a while. And we spoke about your previous book, which was called Carl Van Vechten and the Harlem Renaissance, A Portrait in Black and White. The new book is Black is the Body. It's a beautiful book of essays. It was just so wonderful to read it. And I have to say, I read it, I listened to it. So I had your voice in my ears reading the essays. And they're just so profound and beautiful, each one. I was trying to limit myself to just one a day. But sometimes I would just let it go. I just reread it, re-listened to it last week in advance of this. So it's exciting, and I love the essay form. Everything from Michel de Montaigne to, I remember there was a beautiful book of that Philip Lopate edited a number of years ago that was essays from all times and all places and men and women. It was just the commonality of humankind really comes out. And so I know in this book you start talking about how you have the a line from Zora Neale Hurston. You said the oldest human longing is self-revelation, and you talk about how this book sort of originated when you were in the hospital after you suffered a violent attack in New Haven. Why don't you talk about sort of the genesis of this process?
Sure, absolutely. Well, yeah, I started the book talking about that episode. It was August 7th, 1994. I was a graduate student in New Haven, and I was sitting in a coffee shop, in New Haven, and a man came in. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he stabbed 7 people. I was one of the people he stabbed. I always tell that story, making sure to let everyone know, put everyone at ease, no one died. And it oddly didn't hurt in the way that you would think it would, and that was partly because, has everything to do with the fact that you're not supposed to get stabbed, so it's like there's no vocabulary for your body to kind of articulate the pain in a way that stubbing your toe or something else. But it helped me, the experience helped me in a lot of ways. I mean, it helped me in terms of the book, because I was interested in this book and thinking about the scars that we carry. And this is a scar that I carry that has determined the shape of my life in ways, I have no control over and I could never have predicted. I mean, I survived the stabbing only to go back to the hospital periodically, I'm on my 4th time now, because of adhesions that keep developing in my bowel. So at some point I had to kind of learn to work with this wound. I did my fair share of, shaking my fist at the world and, feeling angry that it happened, but I had to learn to work with it. And as I started to think about that experience and the role it was going to play in the book, I started thinking about the experience of race and of blackness and how, as African Americans, we've always used storytelling to help organize our experiences, to literally liberate ourselves, but also to provide ourselves comfort and to help ourselves remind ourselves that we are human, as much as we have used the storytelling form to insist upon our humanity to white people. We have used it to treat ourselves and to heal ourselves, and so it felt like the right place to begin the book.
And you come from a family of storytellers on your maternal side. You talk about your mother and your grandmother, as you reference in the title of the book.
Yes, that's right. My grandmother was a poet. She was very religious, and so most of her poems are about God. But she was a girl. She fell in love with my grandfather, and she ran off to marry him. And her mother was so disappointed in her. Her mother, who was very rigid and very proper, burned all of her poems. She was so disappointed in her daughter. My grandmother wrote poems for her whole life, but that was a very scarring episode for her, the fact that her mother could do that to her work. My mother was a poet and always had my brothers and me writing poetry till the end of her life. She was writing. In fact, after she died, I found a collection of poems she was working on. And in those poems, she actually was treating some moments that had happened to her as a girl growing up in the Jim Crow South and having rocks being thrown at her by white boys as she walked with her grandmother to a store. She wrote poetry about this, and her grandmother told her, you know, well, these boys are ignorant. You should pity them. But my mother was working out through her poems, but it hurt, you know, and my leg still bled. Who's responsible for that? And I was so impressed, you know, when I discovered those poems, to see how she was using art to try to make sense of her experience and to actually transform it into something beautiful. You know, that is kind of an old tradition for Black people, from the blues, you know, to jazz, to finger the jagged grain, is what Ralph Ellison said, and to take that place of pain and to turn it into something, you know, pretty holy. And that's what my mother did. She also was someone who was pretty religious, but she saw art as part of her religion, if you can follow me there. She saw them as working together, and she used her art to bring her closer to God, really. I think there's a lot of God talk in my book because of that, because there's something sacred for both my mother and my grandmother about the form.
And I didn't give the full title of your book. It's Black as the Body: Stories from My Grandmother's Time, My Mother's Time, and Mine. And well, making art is a very spiritual experience. And whatever you see as your God or your you know, whatever your connection is, I think everyone sort of goes there. It's just fascinating. Your book, you trace there are experiences that are could be identified by anyone, you know, as a wife, as a mother, in your case, as a mother who has adopted two beautiful girls. But there's some, you have one line. It says, "I'm most interested in blackness at its borders, where it meets whiteness in fear and hope and anguish and love, just as I'm most interested in the line between self and other and family, friendship, romance, and other intimate relationships." And that's really sort of what you're plumbing throughout this book. The you know, these intimate relationships, and where you know, where as a Black woman, where you find your line,
that's right. Yeah, I think there's something, maybe, you know, I just was, as you're reading that, thinking about how true that is. In some ways, I wish it weren't true. You know, just because I've just never been somebody who's been able to do the safe thing. You know, I'm drawn to those lines all the time. I think there's no such thing as real intimacy that's safe. You know, we take chances when we reveal ourselves to other people, and that makes a relationship meaningful. But, you know, I think when it comes to telling stories, you know, it's the relationship I want to build with that invisible, that stranger, that reader out there. I believe in it. I think it's fundamental to any kind of human progress. And in terms of racial progress, you know, we can make all kinds of laws and sign petitions and take to the streets, but those incremental human exchanges make us more human. They make us more compassionate and able to understand other people. It's not the whole story, of course, but there has to be in our politics a space for the small p politics of a kind of radical compassion and trying to understand other people. And I hope this book is my way of doing that. You know, I'm somebody who can get overwhelmed by the world, but so the page is really where I go to practice the kind of kindness I have benefited from other people. It's about hopefulness and compassion, but it's also a hand extended to the reader. You know, I really want to bring the reader in. I want that reader to feel comfortable, to feel that she can let down her hair and her defenses and be free, as I'm trying to be free in telling the stories I tell.
So where did you find your place in literature, both as a reader and as a writer, as a young woman and growing up in Nashville?
Well, I think like a lot of kids, you know, I found myself in books. And when I was growing up, you know, in the 1970s, there weren't a lot of Black writers that I knew of, and my parents were, you know, educated in really classic, with kind of classic education. I grew up reading, you know, in school and at home. My mother loved, you know, we read Charles Dickens, and we read, you know, the Brontes. And I made friends with Jane Eyre, you know, like a lot of girls, maybe of my generation, never once thinking that they wouldn't want to be my friend. You know, always imagine, you know, that's one great thing about storytelling, that they enable us to make relationships with people that we would never otherwise know. So I certainly found myself there and imagined that I could have that kind of community with people that I would never know. That's always really thrilled me, actually, about writing and reading, not only, you know, creatively, but in terms of scholarship. But it's possible, because of the words people leave behind, that you can actually know them, people you would never encounter, even if you lived in their time period. So I found myself a lot in that work. And, of course, I grew up in the South, and people were telling stories left and right. You leave the house, somebody's telling a story. It's part of the tradition. So I've always been drawn to that, the narrative as a way to communicate deep feeling. And like Emily Dickinson, you know, you tell the truth, but you tell it slant. So there's something in me that's always appreciated a story as a kind of, you know, you can something to interpret. It's like a riddle or a clue. So I've always been drawn to that, although I found myself, you know, in the classroom lecturing, you know, giving assignments. But for me, I've always been a fan of literature before I've been a scholar of literature, and I've always enjoyed, you know, just the wildness of a good story that takes you in places you, you know, weren't expecting.
I think what's so interesting about your book as well is that you're describing a road that we don't really know where this road is going. And you're talking about yourself as growing up in the South, growing up as a Black woman, and then coming to Yale. And I'm also from the South, and I saw segregation. I saw the hatred that was shown. I mean, that was brutal and horrible. And we're both mothers of young women, and I see my daughter's experience with this. Her friends, it's a rainbow of people. Mm-hmm. and you know, your daughters are originally from Ethiopia, and so they're experiencing, you know, you're passing your experience on to a whole different generation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it is different for our kids. I mean, I think that's really true. I mean, I live in Vermont, but my daughters are, you know, living in a different world than I grew up in. I mean, I grew up in, like you, you know, the kind of slowly desegregating South. My daughters live in Vermont, where, you know, it's definitely, there's a hopefulness about equality and justice here that's part of the fabric of the place that's different than the Tennessee I grew up in, you know. But, of course, there are commonalities, you know, we carry through our skin, regardless of what we want. But they are, it's a different moment. And I think for me in this book, I wrote it at, the girls aren't, my daughters aren't in every essay, but they, I certainly in some ways wrote it for them, you know, sort of a love letter to them and to, but also I think a kind of an admission, I don't know, you know, there are things I carried from my parents, my mother, a story she told me about the dangers of being Black in this world that I needed to know when I was growing up to be safe. And as a kid, I rejected a lot of that. I didn't want my life to be determined by racism. I didn't want it to be inevitable for me. And now I'm a mother, and I catch myself telling my daughters the stories I grew up with, and they have the same reaction to me. They say, well, I my life is different than yours. That happened to you. It's not going to happen to me. And, you know, it would be arrogant for me to say to them, no, absolutely, this is going to happen to you. I also appreciate the fact that they, you know, that they're inventing their own lives, and they have different resources than I did. You know, we have, we are the only Black family in our neighborhood. As I was the only Black family growing up in my neighborhood when I was growing up, my neighbors in Vermont, you know, Knockwood, they really care about my kids. You know, they know them, they care about them. There's definitely a different feeling of community. So just because the neighborhoods look similarly, you know, they're not the same. Time has done its work. But the book for me is about standing squarely in that in between. You know, I'm a daughter, I'm a granddaughter of women, of Black women who endured a lot in the Jim Crow and desegregating South, you know, to make my life possible. And here I stand, and what are the stories I'm going to, what do my daughters need, you know, in terms of the things to protect them and their armor? Do they need the same things? You know, is preparing them for racism, is that a way of making it happen, you know, and kind of inventing it and calling it into to being? You know, it's a question I ask myself every day, and I don't have any clear answers. And I think my book is, I think, in some ways an admission that it would be false to you know, all I have are stories, and really the world is going to be for them to figure out who they are. It's true for all of our children. And so, you know, it's about, I think, every day just trying to meet them where they are. And that's what the book is really trying to do.
I'm speaking with Emily Bernard, and she's a professor at the University of Vermont. Her most recent book is called Black is the Body, Stories from My Grandmother's Time, My Mother's Time, and Mine. Well, it's funny because I've had a couple of play dates with your young girls. How old are they now?
13.
Oh, my goodness. Twins from Ethiopia, Isabella and Julia. And they would play, and this is when they were 3 and 4, and they would play Mommy, and Mommy would be going to the office. So that was their, you know, Mommy is a professional, Mommy is a professor. And so, you know, it's interesting. And also a big part of this book is your husband, John, who is Italian. So,
yes, exactly.
I just watched the Green Book the other night, and have you seen that? I know it's sort of a problematic movie, but at one point it's about Don Cherry, the musician who's being going through the South with an Italian chauffeur and protector, and at one point they have this encounter in a bar, and the men who are, you know, these rednecks are saying, you know, you're the Italian, you're almost black. you're the next thing to it. So that was,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I think John really, I had this funny experience with him where the students at UVM, students of color, were meeting with the president at his home and talking to him about a lot of the issues that they are facing, and they wanted him to understand. And so we're all sitting, and they were running the evening. So we're all sitting in a circle, and they asked, you know, they wanted the president to think about whiteness. So they asked, if you're white, will you raise your hand? And John didn't raise his hand. So I said, excuse me, I'd like to know why my husband didn't raise his hand. And John said, you know, when I'm in a room like this, that's not how I identify myself. He said, I'm at the president's house. I'm a working class Italian immigrant. You know, that whiteness that's out there. And I think that's really interesting and real. And I wish that, you know, we'd all have opportunities to think about our lives in more complex ways, right, than just black. I wish we could allow each other. And maybe we would understand, I mean, this maybe sounds really hokey, but that we do have more similarities. We are all complex. But the kind of the whiteness, again, that he saw that was being kind of interrogated at the president's house didn't feel like who he was, you know. And, of course, you know, he is white, and he's a white cisgender, heterosexual, big Italian dude. So he definitely walks in the world, you know, differently than I do and I can. But I've learned a lot from him actually about the way that class operates in my life that I never really thought of, you know, because that's what privilege means. You don't have to really think about it. You know, my parents were both professionals, you know, and I grew up not knowing not only that was expected of me, you know, it wasn't, that I would have failed them if they did not. That's what they expected, and they're both immigrant, have that immigrant mentality. You know, whereas John grew up, you know, with a different set of expectations. So, you know, I have an essay, of course, in the book about my marriage, and people always imagine that, you know, oh, it's an interracial marriage, and they imagine it's full of this kind of very specific Hollywood kind of, you know, guess who's coming to dinner kind of drama. But in fact, you know, I'm here to say that, you know, as a heterosexual woman married to a heterosexual man, it's complicated. Marriage is complicated. And of course, race is part of that. I don't mean to diminish, you know, the struggles of you know, interracial anything, but I like to think my book is, I think the way that the, I thought about the way the term the body works in the book is that it's got all the parts there, you know, and it's about so many things, about race and gender and love and being a parent. Succeeding and failing as a parent, succeeding and failing as a wife, you know, as a person in the world. I think it's a whole book, you know, it's a whole person, and full of all of the highs and lows in any human experience.
So to get to one essay that's really sort of the meat of the book, and when it came, I remember when this essay came out, teaching the N-word, it was talked about quite a bit, And You know, from that, I want to read a book that you recommended to your students, which is Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word by Randall Kennedy. And that's a word I have a lot of trouble with in any context. And then again, having grown up in the South and having seen it used in hateful ways as ways of establishing power. And this is something that this is ground that you cover with your students. So why don't you talk about this essay and this experience?
Okay, yeah, that was actually the first essay that I ever published was teaching the N-word, and, you know, it was definitely an essay, I think, that sort of came out of me, you know, and it's always, you know, it's always, for me, it was very liberating, very freeing. I think I was teaching a course on African-American autobiography at the University of Vermont, where I still teach, and I had 10 lovely white students, and, you know, I teach at UVM, so it's not unusual to have a classroom. And it was just one of those amazing ironies of life today that I have had full support of my university, my department, to teach this course, you know, to a group of white students, this material that means so much to me. And the students were hungry to learn, and they were ready to learn. And there were a lot of things I wanted to teach them. You know, I'm aware that my students, some of them tell me they're the first black teacher they've ever had, which is, of course, not unusual. That's just the state of, we read the statistics all the time. So I'm very aware of the responsibility I have. You know, I want them to, it's important that they have a black teacher, and it's important that they learn this material, and I'm privileged to be able to teach it at all. But we came upon this rocky territory where the word was in the literature. The question was, you know, how do we approach it? And I was developing a real rapport with these students. I cared about them very much, and I'm always, as a teacher, thinking, how much of myself do I bring into the classroom? You know, in good writing, the writer should get out of the way. And I think in some ways, the same is true of teaching. You know, if you use your experience, it should be to enable the students to learn more. You know, I don't think we should crowd the classroom with our personalities. This should be a conduit to get the students to do the learning. So when I come upon, you know, the N-word and the right, it's always sort of stops me. You know, like, what do we do now? What do we do now? Because the word is saturated with its history. And the essay, I was sort of tired of lecturing. You know, we hear there are a lot of lectures out there about the N-word and language, and they're all important, you know. And bottom line, no. You know, you should not say this word. It is a word that is, you know, the history, it is a product of, it is an expression of racial hatred, the way that it has been deployed in this culture. At the same time, it's also in our music, and hip-hop music is is mainstream music. It is pop culture, hip-hop culture now. It's not, you know, in the margins, it's right in the center, and the word is circulating there, and sometimes it's circulating beautifully in the music, you know, and that can be really destabilizing, and I think in a really interesting way. I'm listening to Solange Knowles, you know, her album, you know, Seat at the Table, and when she says it sounds beautiful. You know, she's good. So what does that mean? I think we can, you know, scold each other and we can slap wrists, and when people say it and they do their public mea culpa, I shouldn't have said it, I backtrack and I apologize, can I please have my career back, you know? And those kinds of public demonstrations, what are they really doing? Because it happens so often. I don't find it satisfying, you know? I want to know why, and sometimes asking that question, you know, can take you to some tricky places. So I literally, in that essay, take the word for a walk. And again, I didn't want to, you know, I'm in the classroom and I'm teaching, but on the page I can be freer and I can ask questions that I don't have the answers to. And that essay, I like to think of it as, again, a refusal to lecture to the reader. You know, I'm not here to give you a straight answer. We all know what the answer is, you know, but I want to know why. I want to know the why of it. Why is a word so compelling? And I wanted to explore how it has operated in my life, you know, in multiple ways. And I wanted to be free to have many kinds of reactions to it, you know, and not to have to be accountable in a kind of linear way, if you know what I mean. You know, I wanted to be able to make mistakes, too. So in some ways, I think the essay is doing the work that I hope the whole book will do, which is to give room for a reader to make up her own mind and to ask her own questions as she's traveling through the book and through that essay, you know, to be able to say those things that you're not supposed to say, which is that, yes, I listen to Solange Knowles, too. You know, I'm a white woman, and I enjoy listening to Jay-Z. I was fascinated in that essay when I talk about this in the classroom. My students had philosophies about that word and when they rule for themselves And I thought that was the most interesting part, you know, not necessarily that what I had to say after having, you know, read tons of dusty tomes, you know, but their lived experience consuming the music, consuming the culture, what it appears, like how they had decided on their own what it meant to them. So, you know, I like to think that the book, I'm trying to do the same thing, which is to allow for a variety of experiences to come through because, you know, that word is, it's an American word, right? It's a word that really describes something really vital and really painful about an American experience. And the same is true for race as it is lived in this country, right? We have invented it here on these shores in a way that it is not experienced the same way anywhere else, right? There's a unique way of thinking about race in this country that does not travel. So I think the book, I'm trying to make space for everybody to be part of the conversation.
The writing in the book is so beautiful, and sort of circling back to where I started, it's the common humanity of what the essay brings, and you as a mother and as a wife and as a woman and living in a body, just all of those things that I think are so common to us, and I did want to ask you just to read a little bit, just to let people get some of the language that's in the book.
Oh, absolutely. Love to. Do you mind if I read a little bit from the moment when we adopted our daughters? I'd like
absolutely.
To read from the essay Motherland about our trip to Ethiopia. So this is sort of squarely in the middle when we haven't met the girls yet, but we're on our way.
But you had a very difficult adoption procedure.
Yeah. It was very dramatic. I mean, it was really its own story. But it all worked out in the end, thankfully. My Africa, motherland of the Negro peoples, the claims Langston Hughes and his 1940 autobiography, The Big Sea. As a very young man, he worked on a ship that eventually docked in Dakar. And me, a Negro, Africa, the real thing to be touched and seen, not merely read about in a book. I had never dreamed of Africa, not once entertained fantasies of an innate bond between me and the continent, not like other African Americans I know or have read about, who believe in a primordial tie that links them to the motherland, one as pure as placenta and persistent as a connective tissue that keeps the body's organs in place. But as I stand holding the pole on the shuttle to the plane that will take us to Mekelle, I feel I am in the middle of something, something bigger than myself, but in which I am somehow involved. I am surprised and pleased when people speak to me in Amharic, the way I seem to blend in, though the presumption of compatriotism doesn't last long. My Americanness is all over me, beneath language, down to the way I laugh and move my hands. My Americanness is in me, too, in the assumptions I brought with me, of which I was not even aware. Assumptions about an Africa gleamed from news reports, famine, poverty, war. That version of Africa directly contradicts what I see around me, men and women lost in thought, sitting and standing in this short accordion-like shuttle, a small waiting plane, mountains as distant as memories, a landscape both dignified and ordinary. This is the real thing, to be touched and seen. Upon boarding the plane, people talk in low voices through the airline attendant's lecture on seat belts and emergency exits. Turn off your cell phones, stow your tray tables. I close my eyes and we take off.
That's beautiful. And you did mention that you're going to be in New Haven coming up at the end of the month for a conference. Is that going to be something at which people can come and hear you talk, or is what is going to be going on with the Beinecke event?
Well, so the event at the Beinecke, it's a biography conference, and you know, honestly, I'm not sure that it is open to the public. But
okay.
Should I find out some things and I can let you know? We could let your listeners know on your website, maybe.
I will. I'll look into it and see if see what's going on. So,
okay.
I hope to have maybe I can have coffee with you at some point during that. That'd be great.
Definitely. I'd love it.
You have so much humor in the book too, and certainly your daughters are the comic relief often. And just the way that they are, you know, as with any kid, and these are profoundly intelligent young women, they're coming up against the reality and how they define it, and in the essay Black is the Body, you say my daughters became black when they were 6 years old, and you talk a lot about how hearing that term, the people who are African American, and they want to be African, they don't like the term African American, they say we're not black, we're brown. So they're quite charming throughout the book.
Oh yeah, well they're it's funny, I wrote a lot of those essays before they had now they're 13. So it's a different story now.
Right, right.
In terms of the kinds of stories that they are, I think, willing to let me share. But this book has grown up with them. I mean, it's been a long time in the making. So they are very much part of these stories and help to shape them. And I, one thing that's great, of course, about being a parent is that you have these people in the house who are surprising you constantly and, forcing you to rethink a lot of things that you assumed. And so I think that's the role they naturally have in my life and naturally have in the book, and that, they are living lives. You think you know the world, and then you become close to other people, and maybe especially to young people and to children, and you realize that you really didn't know much of anything. So I learn a lot every day from them about race and about how they think of it as experiencing it differently. And they're definitely, they're warriors, they're not timid. They're not, they're figuring out the world, and they are ready for the world. And I'm proud of that.
Oh, that's really great. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Emily, and it is a beautiful book. I'm just so happy that you read the audio book. I listen to audiobooks a lot, so it was just so nice hearing your voice in my headphones, and it was like listening to someone tell stories. It was really great.
Oh, I'm so glad. That makes me so happy. I'm really, that makes me enormously, enormously happy, Valerie. Thank you.
And was that an interesting experience doing the audiobook, the recording?
Yeah, it was And I loved it. I was so excited to have the chance to do it. I couldn't believe it, that I was going to get to do it. It was hard. I have so much respect for actors now, like just the way you have to use your voice. Suddenly words that, I use every day, they didn't make any sense to me as I was trying to speak them into a microphone, and, there are two other people there who were listening, and it wasn't easy, and I had to learn to just speak naturally. The sound producer was saying, just talk the way you normally talk, but I was sort of over enunciating everything, because you should say identity. it's okay, you can say it the way you usually say it. So how bizarre it is that it takes the time to learn to just like talk the way you always talk, but I'm glad I did it. I mean, I'm glad I'm really, really happy that they let me do it and that I was able to do it, because it's cool to think that, I am telling the stories actually that I love so much.
Well, thank you again, and I'll look into seeing about your the Beinecke event, if that's open for the public, but I hope to see you soon, and good luck with this. It's a great book. Thank you so much for speaking to us and to the audience. I'm sure everyone really has enjoyed this, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Valerie. Okay, hope to see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Coffee. Okay, bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with Emily Bernard, who is a professor at the University of Vermont. And her most recent book is Black is the Body, Stories from My Grandmother's Time, My Mother's Time, and Mine. And she had several books out. One of her earlier books was about the Harlem Renaissance and the figure Carl Van Vechten. It's also very interesting as a white man, in a black world and sort of identifying those relationships. So this is listener-supported WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. We're online at wpkn.org.